Okay, so we're about to kick off the session, critical minerals and resource extraction in a carbon neutral and circular economy. What are the options? So welcome back. And for those who have just joined us, thank you for coming to this session. I will be your MC for the session as well. And just remember that this particular session, we'd really like it to have some interaction with the audience as well. So please do submit questions on the Q&A app so we can respond to them. I'm going to kick off the session and hand over to our keynote to set the scene, and I'd like to introduce Heinz Schandahl to join me, who is the senior science leader at CSIRO in Canberra, and he serves as a director of CSIRO's Circular Economy Missions Initiative. He's a member of the Circularity Steering Committee and chair of the ACE Hub's Metrics Working Group. He's also a member of the United Nations Environment Programme International Resource Panel, and Heinz will reconnect us with the IRP's work introduced to us yesterday and present this within the Australian context on resources. So thank you, Heinz.
Thank you. It's really wonderful to be here at Circularity for the second time, so thank you very much for inviting me. When we look at our future in our modeling in CSIRO, we think of the circular economy as the kind of strategy that will enable us to be competitive in the future, to be able to engage fully in supply chains, to trade well, to deal with all the economic resilience issues that we're going to have into the future. And it's deeply linked to our innovation. So that's where we're coming from. The environmental and social co-benefits that we're hoping for and for which we need the policy design to be in place, they are also very important. But this is an economic issue we're dealing with. I'm going to do three things in this presentation. First, a quick conceptual view. What's the problem we are dealing with at a very high level and connecting with Janusz Potocznik yesterday? Then talking you through how the Australian economy sits actually in the global economy in terms of how we use materials and how do we know about that. And then thirdly, and that's a bit of an experiment, I want to introduce you to a piece of theory of change and what do we need to do. And that will set us up for then the discussion that we are going to have on the panel about critical materials, which I'm not going to cover in my presentation other than saying materials matter and all materials are critical. When you think about our modern society, we are organized in a systems view, in a system that has three positive feedbacks, so self-reinforcing. Our economic activity, GDP, our quality of life, human well-being, and the materials and energy we use to achieve that, they're all positively linked. The more GDP, the more well-being. The more well-being, the more materials. The more materials, the more GDP. But there's one negative link in the system, and that's creating the triple planetary crisis. So climate change, pollution, biodiversity loss, that's the negative feedback we need to deal with. And as Janusz Potocznik yesterday said, we do that through policy and through innovation. We're looking at resource decoupling and well-being decoupling. So can we achieve the human well-being outcomes, the standard of living, but at much lower levels of material use, waste and emissions? That's really the conundrum here. That's the system we're dealing with. So how do we even know what's going on around us? And the way we measure is with a tool that's called material flow analysis. Many of you will know there's a global manual of how this has been done. But the important point is material flow analysis is organized in a complementary way to the economic accounts. So while we have a headline number, total amount of GDP, we can dig into which kind of sectors contributed to economic growth. We can do the same for materials, for emissions. We can delve into the system. We can understand which sectors of the economy have been less resource efficient, which have been more resource efficient. And Janusz yesterday showed that picture that we are growing from 30 billion tons of material use in the global economy to around 106 billion tons by next year, and projected to go to 160 billion tons. Now, the important information is every kilogram of material that we use, whether it's timber, whether it's biomass, whether it's a fossil fuel, whether it's a metal ore, every kilogram comes with an environmental impact. And so Janusz yesterday talked about the contribution of materials management to overall climate change, biodiversity loss, pollution, and it's tremendous. The problem we have globally, we're also not improving resource efficiency globally. And that's not because countries are not getting more resource efficient as they progress. It's more about that less resource efficient countries having more and more of the economic cake. So we actually have a real problem there. So now let's have a very quick look at Australia. We are among the 10 biggest natural resource extractors globally. We are actually number 6. China is the biggest, 30 billion tons in China. We extract 2.5 billion tons of biomass, metal ores, coal, natural gas, whatever. Very high on a per capita level. It's around 100 tons per capita a year. But we are by far the biggest net resource exporter in the global economy, both in absolute value and per capita. So here's a responsibility and an opportunity. Operating at the front end of what is going to become a circular economy, what does that mean? So let's have a look at our economy from the start, the material input, all the way through the way how we manage materials to the end of the process. So we're extracting 2.5 billion tons of materials. That's the picture for 2019. We're also importing 100 million tons. So these 100 million tons are your Toyota cars, your refrigerators, your air conditioners. When you look at the material footprint of those imports, it's actually threefold the amount. Then we are pushing this material through. 1.5 billion tons are quickly exported and lost, no valorization on those exports. And then 60% of the material that we manage, we are using for food, feed, and energy production. And only 40% then remains in a structural sense, or the furniture around us is made up of this material. A lot of it goes on stock, and then you have some material that turns up in our solid and liquid waste flow. And when we measure circularity, you can do that in different ways. You can either look at the residential waste, which turns up in the collection, and you can ask, how much of this is recycled? We're not so bad, about 50%, but we're also not improving much over time. So, we reach the 50%, and then the next 10% are harder to achieve. But the circularity rate, which is how much of the material that we manage in a year is actually kept in circulation, we're sitting around 5%. So that's very low. When you think about the circularity gap report, which says the world is 7% circular, you kind of think, could we be 100% circular? No, we can't. In Australia, the potential in our current economic structure is 20% circularity. The European Commission, by comparison from the economic structure they are operating, they have a potential of 40%. So we need to close that gap, getting to the 20%, and then raising our potential. So two things to do at the same time. And raising the potential means a transition of the economic system we are currently in. So how do we transition? And I have 3 minutes to think about that. I'm thinking about the linear economy as a dead weight on our economic system. So convenience, low accountability, poor design, most of it ends up in landfill. There's a lot of economic value we are losing. So we're going to imagine, assess, and then mobilize for the transition. Importantly, if we want to accelerate in circular economy in Australia, we need a national agenda, we need national policy. So we're really on track achieving that, I think, with the government's process around the framework. And then to consolidate the circular economy, it needs a global effort. So these are the things that Janusz has been talking about yesterday. But what does that entail? We need to manage energy, technical, and biological materials in very different ways. Or in other words, we need to achieve each of our needs. And again, this goes back to Janusz's presentation yesterday. Our needs for housing, mobility, food, energy, and consumer goods that then furnish all the other things that we do. We need to deliver those in ways that use much less materials, much less waste, lower emissions. Now, these provision systems, as they were called yesterday, they are They are seen as socio-technical systems that have a certain governance around them. Financial incentives are aligned. There's materials and energy that is pumped through. There's an infrastructure that is operated that's in place. And you could say all the current interest, money, infrastructure, the way we do things is actually aligned with the socio-technical system of the linear economy. And then we have our social practices, the things that we do as individuals every day, the kind of things where we don't make decisions, but we just interact with what is around us. And the social practices, the cultures, the behaviors, they're also aligned with the linear system. There's an array of agents, industry, government, civil society, science, obviously. Linda talked about how we can deliver science-based information to the policymakers. So all of this needs to transition. And so when we go through this process of imagining, mobilizing, accelerating, and then consolidating, and in my view, I would say we are at different stages in this process in a different sense. So we have a lot of mobilization acceleration already happening at the national level and in some of the states. But where are the experiments? When you look out of the window, where do you see the circular economy? When you look at how mobility, how housing, how the food system, how energy is organized, where exactly can we see it? Where are the experiments? Where's the mobilization on the ground in our regions, in our cities? And keep in mind, those systems, they consume 80% of the energy, of the materials, of the emissions. So while we might be concerned about what ends up in our residential waste, which is important, but if we could turn around those large provision systems, that would get us a long way. I'd like to say SARO is going to be your transition partner in that process with the ASAP, and I hope that provides a background to the session we're going to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Heinz. I think that was a brilliant setup for our next panel discussion. I certainly didn't know that Australia is the biggest net exporter of materials. But we've got in the current system we're in, 20% potential in circularity potential, but we can do way better than that. But we do need to change the way that it's currently set up, right? So without any further ramblings from me for now, I'm going to introduce our panel to the stage, and I'm going to be the moderator for the session as well. But I promise not to talk too much, I hope. So I'm going to welcome up onto stage, Jill Risley from Deloitte. So Jill leads, and I'm going to just introduce quick bio, but as you know, the bio is on the app, so you can read fully on the app. But just to set the scene, Jill leads Deloitte's sustainability and climate change consulting practice in Australia and provides expert sustainability advice on the circular economy. Please, Jill, welcome. Next is Oliver Menneker, and he is our senior consultant, sustainable water management, climate change and circular economy at GHD. Welcome, Oliver. Ross Lambie, Chief Economist, Minerals Council of Australia, and he's been a Chief Economist and Director of Economics and Industry Policy at the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and held senior positions leading resource, energy and environmental economics at the Commonwealth Government. So welcome. We have one more panelist joining us remotely. So we've got a bit of a hybrid session. So I'm going to be looking at the tech to see if this works, guys. But hopefully, Philippa, I see Philippa. Philippa Schoquist is joining us, and she's an experienced multidisciplinary mining and metals professional with nearly 20 years industry experience. So welcome, Philippa. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, good morning, Sally.
Awesome, excellent, okay. Location. Can you hear me okay? All right. So, welcome, panelists. And I'm going to start with just with a few points. And Ross, if we can start with you, maybe just to kind of take us
over some of the points that you'd like to raise in our panel today while we've got all these people in the room and, to set the scene for us. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for turning up for this session. I think it's a very important session, and I particularly want to thank the organisers for inviting me back this year to share my views on things. The issue is, when I had a look at the title of this session, I think what's missing is the role of critical minerals in terms of getting us to a circular economy. We're in a transition that's leading to transformations, and there's major transformations going on globally. We've got the transformation that we'd all like to see to a circular economy. We've got transformations as part of that in terms of getting us to net zero and the clean energy systems that we need to be able to deliver that. And in order to deliver those systems, we're going to need a vast amount of mining. We're going to need a vast amount of processing to be able to create the material that's going to have to build that new system. And the issue is, we don't have that new system yet, so we've got to rely on the one we do have. And in 2022, 82% of primary energy consumption came from fossil fuels. If you take hydro out, 7% from renewables. So we've got a long way to go. We've got a lot that has to happen, and we haven't got a lot of time to do it. So that's the first point I'd like to make. The second point simply is that it's a vast opportunity for Australia. We are a major resource exporter. Part of the reason we have the living standards we have today is because of that, and we shouldn't lose sight of it. And the final point I'd like to make is we generally need a better understanding of where things come from and how they're made. We need to be more sophisticated in how we think about things. And what I'm talking about in terms of the we here, people in general, they need to understand what the trade-offs are, what's involved. And once they do understand, I think it helps them in terms of getting them on the journey.
Thank you, Ross. And maybe to ask the question, how many of us have been on a mine of any sort? Well, that's quite a good number. Excellent. How many of us have been on a landfill site? Excellent. Good. So I think it's really important that we can make those connections, and if we've made those connections, then at least we have that experience as well. But it's important to communicate that to people that maybe haven't had those experiences of where our things actually come from. So thanks very much for Ross for doing that. We're going to work our way through the panel first, and then we'll come back to some questions. So Oliver, over to you.
Yes. Thank you for having me here, and it's great to be surrounded by so many professionals who have worked in the mining industry probably much longer than I have. But I have also the privilege to work for a services a company that has a lot of internal knowledge that helps me to skill up and work in the field of sustainability and circular economy going forward. So what I thought today, I briefly want to talk about two little balls in the system of the broader circular economy that I'm attached to through my work to give you a little bit of that context. So one of that is the revalorization of mine waste. So one of the big toxic outcomes of the mining industry. And the other one is, we already heard that, accelerating the green transition, the green energy transition, obviously also doesn't stop when we talk about the processes happening on the mine site itself. So obviously, with the tailings, the idea behind it is, and it's just one little element when we talk about the tailings, which I will go a little bit more into detail, is that it's already material that has been mined. It's closer to the surface. So it has many materials in it, often the primary materials that we're looking for, like the gold, the nickels, the copper. But obviously, there's lots of other materials as part of the composition of that mine waste that has come out. And the challenge here is that it's very individual. On each mine has their own type of composition. and also the types of processes that are being used to extract that kind of materials. So we have a lot of materials sitting there that could be mined, but there's not much knowledge around what's actually there, because even though we know what may be in it, we don't know what's the distribution in the big pile that sits in front of us, and different types of technologies have to be applied depending on what we want to extract. So it's really much about making this knowledge available and brokering that knowledge across the different players within the mining sector and the technology providers that come up with new ideas on how to deal with this. And that also includes me. I'm looking at my phone. Like, each of us has a role to play in terms of the demand side of things as well. One big passion of mine is also sustainable water management, and obviously in the tailings, we use a lot of water to process minerals, and so we have a lot of pollutants within the minerals, and we have the water bound into the tailings storage facilities. There are additional opportunities, not only the critical minerals we may extract from those piles, but also what happens to the water. How can we make sure we don't have any unintended consequences of water spilling out? And I'm sure you're all aware of the big disaster that happened over the years. So there's a big attention to that. And what I can say is there's a lot of work actually going in within the mining sector to tackle these kind of these challenges. And so there's actually a lot of stuff happening, but it's such a complex process that it really, we have the different buckets of groups that collaborate already, but how can we bring it up to a higher level so it's also understandable to the consumer, to the product developers, so we get a better understanding of where those materials come, because with the green energy transition, we also have to make sure that we need to fill up the bucket initially first before we can work with it and recirculate the materials. I'm already over time, so I better wrap up. The other thing was in the decarbonization of, for example, the big haul trucks that happen that need to move around the materials on the mine itself. So there's also big initiatives going on how you can actually electrify or decarbonize those kind of haul truck fleets, and there are many global miners working together with innovative companies around the world from the train, the aviation industry, to solve these kind of problems. So I leave it there. There's lots to say. And I hand over.
Thanks, Oliver. What
Oliver didn't mention is he's using his phone, but the font, I'm not joking, it's two point. Like, I don't know how you could read that, so I'm super refreshed. So there's a couple of things I know I'm preaching to the converted here. I think one of the key takeouts from Heinz's one of those slides is we simply can't continue to extract materials from the earth at the current rate. It's simply not sustainable, and we all know that. The other point is a circular economy is not just recycling better, and I think that sometimes gets lost in the weeds a little bit. It's, the recycling, as we all know, is that last little bit of the circle in the circular economy. So I think one of the things, particularly with critical minerals, is we need to really think about it as a systems change and as an economic change. Mm-hmm. I think Heinz mentioned Deloitte and Circular Economy produce each year the annual circular gap report. This year we went backwards to 7.2%. The 2024 report comes out in February. It landed in my inbox this morning. I haven't opened it because I was scared I'd tell you the new figure instead. But it will be really interesting to see, are we improving or are we going backwards? And I did read a report last week that was saying if the world can get to 19% circular, then we reach our Paris targets without doing anything else. And so I think the importance of circularity is often underestimated. Some of the impacts of circularity with critical minerals I think are incredibly beneficial. One is around the provenance of materials from an ESG perspective, knowing where have those materials come from, what are the ESG credentials, are they conflict metals? Knowing that and actually being able to secure that is really important. And, of course, that security of supply chain, particularly in a dynamic and changing world that we find ourselves in. some of the really innovative models that we're seeing overseas are things like the modularisation, which is absolutely critical in terms of repairability. Being able to take things apart and replace what is needed to be replaced is critical. And that the mindset shift around leasing. What do you need to own and what do you need to lease? And the risk profile of leasing and who owns it and who's responsible for it actually changes how things are designed and manufactured quite dramatically. The other thing, when we're looking at sort of that revolution of business models, there's a group in the UK that I'm keeping my eye on called River Simple. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It's absolutely fascinating. It's hydrogen car leasing, zero emissions, just a really innovative business model, which I love. But then also companies that are like Fairphone, who are trying to disrupt and differentiate through ESG credentials effectively. But there are some pretty big barriers that we have. So one is that our tax and accounting systems are built on a linear system, and they are built in many instances to incentivize consumption and to incentivize the purchasing of new materials. And so things like depreciation, the valuation of assets is really problematic. I've got some bright people back at the office looking at it, but it is really problematic. And we are going. My view is we will need to see reform in that space to really accelerate a circular economy. You know, my mother was a lover of antiques, and when you look at things like a chair or a bureau or whatever it might be, a headboard, you know, something to be 100 or 200 years old is seen as an asset. But strangely enough, you know, the way we value things, particularly in a corporate setting, it has a five-year life. Why is a building valued over a 50-year time frame? Well, you know, Vienna has many buildings which are, of course, hundreds and hundreds of years old. Why are we not building things to last for the period that they are able to last rather than building things to have planned obsolescence? And I think planned obsolescence is incredibly problematic, and it's one of the things that we need to overcome. And the last thing is I think the importance of a fair transition is really, really critical. If we're going to rebuild an economy and rebuild business systems, let's make sure that we build it better and we build it fairer.
Thanks so much, Jill. And interesting to bring in that asset and the depreciation and built to last, especially following on from the previous session, which was about design. So, yeah, great. Philippa, over to you.
Thanks, Hay, and good morning from Brisbane. Sorry I can't be there to join you today. Would have loved to have been there in person. A couple of points that have already been touched on that I would like to elaborate on as well. I think to Ross's point that, you know, by 2050, the global population is projected to increase by nearly 25%, up to nearly 10 billion people. So with that comes an increased demand for finite mineral resources. At the same time as there's an increased societal expectation for a low carbon and a low impact future. So mining for decades has operated on a linear extract and transact model that focuses on the mine as being the asset. But will that focus still enable us to provide the significant volumes of finite critical minerals and also transition metals to enable the energy transition? So for those, you know, familiar with mining, there's common terminology about life of mine that's used for the planning and investment process. But is it time that we start having a look at the life of the commodity and what that might look like in the circular model? So look, let me frame that in the sense of the three P's for circularity for mining and metals. The first is provenance, which Jill touched on a little earlier. The second around performance, and the third is around perpetuity. So in the provenance aspect, you know, Jill's touched on it about the geographical location. So where does that commodity actually come from? And what are the credentials of that location? The second aspect is also the source of that commodity. So is it a primary commodity? Is it a secondary or recycled? Perhaps it's also a materials engineered. There's some new fantastic innovative technology that's coming out about creating new commodities or new mixes of commodities. The second aspect around performance looks at ESG performance. And you know, we know that that's an increasing expectation We've heard in the past about license to operate. What we're seeing is it's now license to access market for products as well. So that will become an increased expectation. And Australia is very well positioned in terms of ESG credentials to support that. The second of the performance is actually around how the commodity performs. So, you know that copper is conductive, it's portable, flexible. So what opportunities do we have to actually increase our research and development prowess to improve the conductivity of the copper that we already have, and so that it can continue to increase its value over time throughout a circular process? The third is around perpetuity. So the way that it's, and this is a very broad brush, but the way the system's currently set up is around, currently we have one bite at the cherry. So we have one bite to realise value from a commodity. So what does that look like in the future if we are able to realise economic value, but also social value from that commodity as well? And I think Jill's touched on this previously, but Ellen MacArthur Foundation identified that about 50% of carbon emissions reduction actually comes from how you produce materials and how you produce the products. So that will be critically important for a lower carbon future as well.
Thanks, Philippa, and almost bang on time. Did you time yourself? Brilliant.
No, but that's
really great. Thanks so much. I'm going to just go through a couple of questions and then I'm going to head on to see the Q&A because we have got a couple of questions coming through there too. So, Ross, I'm going to start with you. And you commented that we need a more sophisticated understanding of where things come from and how they're produced. What does this mean in the context of circular economy and the clean energy transition?
Well, what it means is that we usually have pretty good systems thinking, but what we don't understand is the inertia in those systems. And it takes time. And, you know, when we look over the last 20 years, if you look at across all mining activity globally, on average, from discovery to production is 15.7 years. Now, when it comes to mines like lithium, you know, when you go through the approvals process, you can get a lithium mine up in about 4 years. But for copper and nickel, you know, you're talking north of 15 years. Now, on our most recent estimates, by 2030, in order to put us on the pathway for the transition, we're going to need 140 new copper mines, 60 new nickel mines, 50 new lithium mines, and 17 new cobalt mines. That's by 2030. Well, just based on what I said, it's unlikely to happen. So we've got to understand that we have an imperative here in getting to net zero. We have an energy system that needs to be absolutely transformed. The task is huge. So a lot of activity has to take place as quickly as possible to deliver those materials. Because we haven't built the system, we can't rely on recycling. Recycling will play a role post 2030, there's no doubt about that. But we're still going to need a lot of material extracted.
Thanks. Sobering. I'm feeling slightly depressed. So do you think then there's... do we need to be looking at the efficiency and demand side of things in parallel to what you've just said now in terms of... Yeah, I mean... Australian industry accounts for 44% of the nation's end-use energy. 52% of that is for supplying process heat and natural gas. Should we be focusing, and I know we are, there are some areas where we are focusing on the energy efficiency side of things and different grants, etc., especially for industry. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, look, obviously energy efficiency, materials efficiency is very, very important. But there's really three options you've got. You know, you can either try to get more out of your current extraction processes. So, you know, as Oliver highlighted, how can we find more of the material that's actually out there from producing mines and the tailings, etc.? The other one is, how do we bring on new supply? So, new mines. You know, where are the opportunities to do that in order to help meet that growing demand? And the third one is, how do we change or reduce the material requirement for the things we need?
Yeah.
Now, That third one is really promising, but that third one is also really challenging because, you know, that relies on us innovating, discovering, implementing new technologies and learnings to do that. So coming back to my earlier point, understanding time is absolutely critical here. And I think, you know, just coming to your point about, you know, getting depressed, we shouldn't get depressed. I think we just got to be realistic.
Yeah.
And we've got to say that where we find the ability to make progress, you know, that's good. We lock it in. And we just keep building on it because at some stage we'll get the breakthroughs we need.
Mm.
But I think, you know, understanding the challenge, that's the first step we all need to really grasp.
100%. And where I come from, you never waste a good crisis, right? Mm. So sometimes crisis actually does drive that innovation. It drives a different way of thinking. So absolutely. In terms of our panel, would any of you like to jump in on the energy efficiency on the industrial level? Which question? Oliver?
I mean, as Ross said, it's kind of one of the many components. So we're talking about the reduction, the avoidance as kind of the first step. For example, even when we talk about like the production or the extraction itself, like how can we have less of an impact? We use new technologies, but we always have to keep in mind, what is our emissions that we may generate at the same time? Because we often, like as part of an organization, you naturally kind of inward focus, I would say, and because you need to look after your business. And often the benefits accounting for what you do may not occur like within your own, within your own kind of boundaries. And so you would have to share that. So there needs to be that kind of culture set of, this collaboration, the knowledge brokering that brings the different groups together, which already happens. But I think we need more of it. I mean, we always hear about stakeholder engagement fatigue and other kind of issues, but we also need to find innovative ways to come together and matchmake different organizations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe even looking towards those industrial symbiosis type of examples. Jill, on that, what innovative business models have you seen for the circular economy internationally, which may apply to critical materials?
There are a lot, and they're emerging, but we need to move those models from cottage industries to mainstream. And so one of the really interesting things, back to emissions, one of the really great things I think that's happened in the last couple of years is also the focus around biodiversity and natural capital and the complexity of the emissions discussion. It's not just, you drive a car and there are emissions. It is so much more complex than we are in a system. And to circular models and industrial symbiosis, I think some of the great things I've seen overseas, a few of the examples, precincts and the creation of circular and low or zero carbon precincts. So really that industrial symbiosis is really important. And Sydney Water, for example, are doing some great work around that at the moment. And it's as are Barwon Water doing what is a clean economy strategy. So taking their renewable energy strategy and their circular economy strategy and pulling them together. Mm. But critical to that is that systems thinking. So what do you put next to each other?
Mm.
And a lot of the examples we see overseas, Denmark has a number of them. The use of heat is often incredibly useful because it is in a climate where it snows during winter. Now, we don't have that in many parts of Australia, but we need to think more innovatively about what do we place where and how do we create those precincts and what's a commercial leasing arrangement in a precinct setting. And I think that's an emerging field that I think is really interesting. The other one is I think the mindset shift around, and back to leasing, if you were if you take out your phone and you think about your phone and you think if you leased that phone from Apple And let's imagine for a second Apple doesn't actually really own that phone. They are leasing the critical minerals and the components of that phone. And when you need to hand back your phone, and my humble opinion is, I think if you were leasing a phone, the average Australian wouldn't have four redundant phones in their top drawer, which is what happens at the moment. And so making sure that we get those minerals back and into circulation, I think they're some of the models that we're starting to see. It's a mindset shift, and who owns the materials that you have in your phone. Brambles is a great example in Australia, a real homegrown success story. Brambles, CHEP, their pallet business, they own the pallets. So that they lease the pallets, and per day you pay for your pallet, and they have the data on where the pallets are. And what's really interesting for Brambles is that I'm not sure if Lachlan's here, hi Lachlan if you are, the data insights that's providing creates increased efficiency, because they know how long a pallet is sitting outside, if it's a refrigerated pallet, whatever that might be. So I think some of these new models will actually also start to flush out efficiencies that are unexpected. So I think the new business model paradigm is something Australia needs to lean into a lot further, because we're seeing Europe a lot further down the road than we are here.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. And you've raised a number of points there. So I'm going to I'd like to raise and maybe briefly chat through the materials or minerals as a service that is coming through and was discussed at the World Circular Economy Forum. And research is on its way in terms of really understanding what this could mean, especially for emerging economies that are also highly extractive. But before we get onto that, because I think that might be a whole nother topic, I just want to pause for Philippa to see if you're able to provide some examples from your experience in terms of seeing progress in terms of mines and circularity, and then we can. And if you've got insights in the materials or minerals as a service as well, please, share.
No, thanks, Ali. And Jill touched on some exciting developments in the industry in that space around the metals as a service component. There was some interesting research conducted by Columbia University, NL Foundation, in conjunction with ICMM earlier this year, looking at mining and circularity. And what they presented it as was almost two halves of the same coin. So we have process circularity, about how a mine actually operates, and Oliver touched on a couple of the points around tailings recovery. As our processes get better and the tech gets better over the years, how do you actually reprocess materials that you already have? There's also the aspects around full value mining as well. So what is the full suite of minerals and metals that is actually in a resource, and how do you actually extract the best value from that deposit? The other aspect is around post-mining land use as well. So we're seeing some really interesting examples about what happens after the resources are extracted. How can that land be used for the best environmental and social purposes as well? So there's a collective or a holistic view around what happens to the land afterwards. On the product circularity side, we've talked about the recycling materials aspect, some of the benefits being that recycled aluminium uses 90% less energy than the equivalent ton of virgin materials as well. There's some challenges there around the length of time that metals actually are in circulation. So an aluminium can is about 30 days on average. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have steel, which is 50 plus years when it's used in infrastructure and buildings. So there'll be different approaches for different commodities and different uses, which makes it a little complicated. There's also the opportunity for the strategic partnerships. And this is touching on Jill's point around the product as a service and metals as a service. So starting to see more of the mining companies actually go into a partnership with, say, the car manufacturers, and talking about supplying a particular commodity or a suite of commodities to say, look, here's our full offering. And what does that look like for a package in a car? And what happens after the car has come to its end of useful life and then goes back to the miner or the processor. So it's looking at ways to actually lean into who has the right experience and the capabilities to manage that resource to its highest value as long as possible.
I think that's a really great point, and it actually brings us back to an earlier conversation about involving the different stakeholders along the value chain, because I'm not sure those conversations are already happening from a mine to the manufacturing or the processing in between, and it just gets moved along, right? So I think that's a really important point. And I think we need more time to discuss all of this stuff. But I'm going to go to the first part of our questions, and it's not necessarily aimed directly at anyone specifically. But so do we understand how much of the resources we need are already in circulation in some form or alternatives identified, hence capping extraction at some point? Ross, do you want to try that one?
Look, if anyone's interested in truly looking at how we globally decarbonise and what's required, I'll point you to the work that Simon Michaud from the Geological Survey of Finland, and he's in the circular economy unit there, has done. Because there's no shortage of information coming out about, you know, critical minerals that are required or materials required, and then there's all this issue about how we define what a critical mineral, and I think as Heinz said in his day, everything's critical. Let's just accept everything is critical. So Simon's work looks at 2018 and looks at the total amount of energy that was consumed globally in 2018. And he poses the question, right, if we are going to replace this current energy system with one based on renewables, battery storage, pumped hydro and hydrogen, and biomass to deal with industrial heat, what would that involve? And I'm not going to tell you anything about the materials required because they're just unbelievable, but I'm going to tell you the energy system has to be 40% bigger globally than what it was in 2018. 40%. Now, to build the wind turbines, the solar panels, the battery storage, it's all extremely materials intensive. And the electric vehicles. You know, there's 1.4 billion vehicles on the roads in the globe today. And when you look at what got sold in 2022, there was something like 67 million personal vehicles, about 60 million motorbikes. And what we're estimating in terms of 2023, globally, there'll be 14 million electric vehicles sold. So it's a lot. So my point is, there's a lot of stuff that has to be built. We are far, far away from capping extraction. We will need to. There are finite limits that are coming into place here. And that's why the circular economy is really, really important. But look, it's that old problem. It's that old Alice in Wonderland problem. You know, she rocks up and there's a Cheshire cat and there's a fork in the road and she goes, which way do I go? And our cat just sort of looks at her and says, well, it depends on where you want to get to. Well, we know where we want to get to. But when she says she doesn't know, the cat just goes, well, it doesn't matter which road you take. The key point here is, in terms of that story, is it wouldn't have mattered which road Alice took. It was going to the same destination. For us, it does matter because that path sets us up in the future and has implications for what it means to the lives of people. So the path is really important. Understanding path dependency and lock-ins really important. So I say, we've got to be very pragmatic about this. We've got to seek the opportunities as they arise and we've got to grab them.
Thanks for that. I'd like to step in here. Yeah.
I think the resource intensity of the transition to a low carbon economy is often underestimated or not just, it's the elephant in the room. One of the key things I think we need to understand, though, to the question around do we know where the Do we know where the stuff is? Do we know where the minerals are? Do we know where particularly those critical minerals are? I think that's something that's what we really need to wrap our arms around. So things like digital product passports, we need to understand what the components of materials are, and then to be able to map that and understand that so that we can recover them and put them back into the system. And I think we're seeing, we're increasingly seeing that, and I think that the benefits that we've discussed, you know, around the provenance of those materials is really beneficial. But that's something that is broadly pretty untapped at the moment, I think. And I think having that increased awareness of the components of items and things like we've seen in France, the repairability index, for example, that's really interesting in terms of understanding what's in it, but also how can I repair it? And I think that's going to start to play a greater role.
Yeah, so it's kind of really understanding, do we have enough in our current system at the moment that we can recover? Doesn't sound like it. No. So it does sound like we need a fundamental change, shift, at multiple levels to kind of understand what it is that we actually need, what is the actual demand, where might we get it, and how quickly we can get there. And I'll always think of Alice in Wonderland in a very different way. So we're almost at the end, but what I'd like to do is maybe just give each of you just the opportunity to, in like a minute, just to, you know, just provide your last thoughts or insights in what you would like the audience to do, take away from the session. And Philippa, I'd like to start with you.
No, thank you. And probably comes back to the comment I made at the beginning around shifting the mindset around the life of mine to the life of the commodity. And by doing so, will that change our how we value commodities, how we use commodities as a consumer, and how we're looking for opportunities and ways to ensure that that commodity continues to circulate at its highest value for as long as possible.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Ross?
Look, I think what transitioning from a linear economy to a circular one, we've got to start bending the line, okay? And I think the other thing is we've got to look at this from a global perspective. There's nothing wrong with us extracting material and exporting it elsewhere for things to happen to it. Circularity should be viewed globally.
Great point. And boom, leaving it there, because it is. We didn't speak about that. We didn't speak about trade. That we all live in a global village. So, yeah, absolutely. So thanks for raising that point and something to ponder over lunch. Oliver?
Maybe coming back, I guess, to the data and the knowledge sharing and the approach to that, because we often already have the end in mind. We want this complete data set that we want to deal with, and then we know exactly where is what, and then we can calculate the footprints of how much we produce, transporting it from one end to the other end. But I think that it's like the stepwise approach. We need to get the different groups involved accustomed to that idea of sharing information, and even just the information that someone else, a technology provider, for example, knows that this information is available on demand for like a commercial transaction to start with, that's something that you could, that needs to be promoted further in bringing, different groups together that kind of facilitate the knowledge from the universities, from, the technology providers, from the miners themselves to create these ecosystems. I guess the ecosystems that what we kind of heard a lot, and thinking about the stewardship of obviously the whole life cycle across the value chain. And we're all part of the value chain. We drink clean water treated with chemicals coming from the mining industry. We're all using phones, multiple devices. So we're all playing this part also in our consumer behavior.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'd echo what's been said, and particularly what Philippa's comments. I think that the importance of data is absolutely critical. I also think understanding those material flows is critical. I think one of the things I'd really encourage us also to turn our minds to is value leakage. Cars are such a great example of value leakage, and how often do a lot of people actually use their cars? And I think understanding where are the opportunities for immediate intervention when we have a longer-term transition, particularly around commodities, it's an exciting space.
Absolutely. So thank you to the panel and to the audience for the questions. We haven't touched on a couple of really important points, being trade, the just transition to this as well, and in terms of where a lot of these critical materials do come from, often from emerging economies, and what does that look like, and how do we participate in a very in an equitable way, is something that we should be thinking about when we are operating in these systems, and really just, I think, really trying to retain as much value in our system as possible that we can, knowing that we each part of the system is incredibly important, and not to say that it's somebody else's issue. We all need to kind of get more involved, more in tune with where our things come from. We do with food. We want to know where our food comes from. So maybe we should get to know a little bit more about where the stuff in our phone comes from, and how often we actually need to change our phone. Probably not every 2 years. So just little things like that could probably make quite a big difference. So thank you so much. Thank you, Philippa, and I'm so glad the tech worked. So please, thank our panel up here. It's been great. Thank you. So just as a final, you guys are welcome to stay here if you like. But just to kind of wrap us up, now I can put this down. Apologies. I'm just going to stand. Is that we're going to have lunch, but we are going to have a slightly shortened lunch, 45 minutes. So the next sessions will start at 1 p.m. To get us back on track. So thanks again, everybody, for the session, and enjoy your lunch.